family. My name is John. I'm an addict.
Hey,
got to tell you, I'm extremely, extremely, extremely nervous. I've been sitting out there praying to be able to get through this. Strength through adversity. You know, the program committee first asked me to share on the 12 step a couple of weeks ago, and when I got here, it kind of changed to this. I had already written the script because I know about the steps, because I've worked the steps. I'm on my third cycle through the steps. And I'm thinking strength through adversity. When I thought about strength through adversity, I had to tell you guys, I had to take notes, write some notes just to kind of keep me on point, because I sit up here and I freeze up. I asked Joyce P to let me come up first, because if I had to sit there, I was going to get up and walk out the room. You know, that's how much fear I got. Talk about strength through adversity, and I thought about it, you know, if I just shared my story, you know, that's strength through adversity. And when I thought about strength through adversity, I was thinking, you know, death, disease, destruction, you know. And I was thinking, you know, I'm not really suffering from any disease. I thought about it, I got the disease of addiction, you know. I haven't really experienced any death from anyone since I've been clean. Only destruction is destruction that I've done, personally. My adversities most of the time are from living in a fantasy. You know, I came in here, I learned how to live in reality. And a lot of times the adversities that I think I'm going through are when I think things should go a certain way, or people should treat me a certain way, and things don't go that way now, and I'm caught up in my own brain, and I can't find a way out. You know, last night I went down to the hotel and asked the lady for a dictionary so I could look some words up. Because I got caught up, I didn't know what to do, and I went back to the basics, you know, get a dictionary. And adversity, it says a state of affliction or hardship, misfortune. Strength is a state of being strong, powerful, to withstand strain, stress, and force. Talk about a toughness, power to sustain, or source of power. You know, my source of power is my higher power. And I was introduced to my higher power through Narcotics Anonymous. You know, my home group is, my clean date is 2-7-1993. My home group is Walk to Walk in Laurel, Maryland. We meet on 198 and Conti Road. As one of my home group members say, across the street from the Giant, for the people that are a little confused. And, you know, I'm just sharing my story. You know, I was, you know, I grew up in a pretty normal family. I have six sisters. I'm the youngest of all of them. You know, I never knew my dad. My father died when I was 19 months old. Only thing I know about him is the pictures that I've seen and the stories that I hear about him. And I was pretty much a sheltered guy. When I was coming up, I was, you know, my family really protected me. And my mother always told me, don't do this, don't do that. They got me into the sports and that kind of stuff. And I was never really able to get out of the neighborhood. I was one of them guys. I did the normal stuff. You know, we played football in the middle of the street, breaking people's mirrors with the football, you know, because I grew up on 9th and Buchanan Street, Northwest D.C. So we played football in the middle of the street, and, you know, we played basketball, and we went roller skating and stuff like that. And, you know, when I grew up, I always, when we were playing football in the middle of the street, the guys on the corner was where I really wanted to be. Because they looked like they were having so much fun. You know, they just really looked like they were enjoying life. And as the women came by, the women always stopped and talked with them. And they just seemed to be a power of attraction to me. You know, they talked real cool. They walked real cool. They dressed real cool. And that was attraction to me. But every time I would go on a corner and hang out with them, you know, my mother would look out the window and be like, hey, what you doing? Play football. Get back in the house. And, but they always were attracting to me. And then they moved to the alley. And when I was in the house, my room was on the backside of the house, and I would just peer out in the alley and look at them. And they would be having so much fun with the cases of beer and smoking the weed, and they just looked like that was the place to be. Not up in the house, you know. And it wasn't until I got in the ninth grade, in my area, when you get in the ninth grade, you go to high school. So when I got in the ninth grade to go to high school, I got a little more freedom. They kind of loosened up the reins on me. And I was able to, I didn't have to come straight home from school anymore. what I did was I was signing myself up for the extracurricular activities. I joined the track team and stuff like that to give me an opportunity not to have to hurry up back home. And through the process of doing that, I stopped doing those things that I signed up for, and I was hanging out. And I was doing the things that I wanted to do. And when I got with the guys, and they accepted me, you know, sitting on the track instead of running track, we would sit up in the bleachers, and that's when the little pony beers came out. We would drink the pony beers. When the guy gave me my first pony and called me by my name, like when I came in here and you guys call me John, or when I go to my regular meetings that I go to and I come in, and people are like, hey, John, they give me a hug, you know, you feel good, familiarity. And when they gave me that pony, I was like, man, I'm in, you know, and the taste was horrible. Taste of beer to me was horrible, but I learned to like it, and it tastes good to me. But we would do, they give us the pony, I drink the pony, and then the thing was, after you drink it, throw it on the track. Stupid. And I was a follower, so that's what I did. I drunk my pony, when I finished, bam, throw it on the track. What I found out by being here is that, you know, I'm a follower. And being a follower always got me in trouble. My mother always told me, don't be around that guy. Don't be around those people. But I didn't want to hear what she had to say because she was stopping me from having fun. She just didn't want me to have fun. So, you know, we were on the track. We were throwing the beer. I didn't like the beer, but they were drinking it. They wanted me to drink it, so I drank it. Then I started liking the beer. Next thing, they would break out the joint. And when they were smoking the marijuana, it really didn't smell good to me, you know. But they were smoking, and I wanted to be with them, so, you know, hand me the joint. You know. And then the effects came in, and I started feeling it. I was really a shy guy, and they were talking to the women and rapping to the women, and I was like, you know, I really like to do that one day, you know. And there were girls in my class that I was really attracted to, but I really didn't know what to say to them because I was a shy guy. I was afraid of, you know, people just not wanting to, what do you call it, people not wanting to talk to me or whatever. So, but when I got the drugs in me, I was no longer attracted to the women in the class. It was a teacher. That's the truth. You know, I have extremes. I'm either all the way down or I'm all the way up. I don't want anything in the middle. And it used to be the basketball, the football, the going skating, and then it got to the point where, you know, we had to get the beer and the marijuana to go skating and to play basketball and play football. Then it got to the point where, screw the basketball and the football, let's just get high. And I started throwing away my dreams. You know, you stand on the corner with the guys, and a very nice car go by, and we used to play that stupid game, that's mine. I don't know if anybody ever did that before. The pretty woman go by, that's mine. And instead of trying to get those goals and implementing some things in my life to try to get those things, I sat there and I sold my dreams by just pointing out what I wanted. And the guys, and these guys were 15, 20, 30 years older than me. You know, here I am. I guess in the eighth grade, you're what, 13, 14 years old. You know, I'm hanging out with them. And my mother was telling me, well, look at them. Look at people who you want to be like. Look at people who are doing things that you want to do, and that's who you be with. Well, that's what I was doing. That's who I wanted to be like. But I wasn't looking at the real picture. I wasn't looking at that they were going back home sleeping in mother's basement. That, you know, every now and then they were borrowing from me a dollar or two. I'm 13, 14 years old. These grown men want a dollar or two from me. No, but I wasn't looking at the fact that they weren't doing that. I was looking at it. It was cool because people were giving it to them. And we looked up to the guys. Hey, man, what you want? I got five. Take four. Because I wanted to be with them. And, you know, that was the progression of the disease. You know, that's how it was all downhill from there. I'm going to fast forward a little bit. After I went through all of that, you know, I got out of high school. I really don't know how I got out of high school to this day. Because toward the end, I went to high school to meet up with my friends, you know. And we would get to school and then go off and do whatever we want to do. So I really don't know how I got through high school. And I don't know if anybody experiences, but sometimes, even at my age, you know, I celebrate a birthday down here. My birthday was Friday. I'm 39 years old. This convention changed the date about 4 years ago, so it's been falling on my birthday. I've been spending my birthday here. This is my I have 11 years clean. I've been at this convention for 10 years, and I've been on service every year. I've been on service at every level at this convention except for this where I am now. And I've done workshops at other meetings, other conventions. But this is my home. This is my convention, CPRCNA. So this is a blast to be able to do this. You know, and I hope everybody that wants to do this get the opportunity to do it, no matter how nervous you are. where was I? I was still at high school? Oh, okay. Well, I got out of high school. And I would tell you, I don't know if anybody had this dream, but sometimes even at my age, I dream that I'm still trying to get out of high school. And I wake up and I'm like, ooh, I'm out. Yeah. Or I dream that I'm getting high. And I wake up, ooh, I'm still clean. Awesome feeling to have accomplished something that seemed so difficult. Getting clean, man, it was, I never thought I'd be able to do it. I was a chronic relapser. Went to a couple of different treatment centers. When I came out of high school, I went to a trade school. And when I came out of trade school, I figured I was going to make a whole lot of money. I got the skills now, right? When I came out there and I finally got a job in my trade, they wanted to pay me $7 an hour, right? But my student loans were like $15,000, and y'all want to pay me $7 an hour. So through just not participating in life, I started still hanging out with the guys that were getting high, and I remember walking downtown on 9th and F with a friend of mine, and we were smoking marijuana like it was legal. And downtown is like, you don't walk through downtown smoking weed. That just ain't the thing to do. And this Marine walked by me. He was like, what are y'all doing? Come here. And this guy had his dress blues on. He was looking good, and the women were all looking at him. And he said, come here, let me talk to you guys. Well, at that time, man, life was just really bad for me. Nothing that I tried seemed to work. And I was getting a little discouraged. And he talked with me and my buddy, and he just looked good, and he dressed good and sound good. And he talked us into joining the Marines. Right. Yeah. You know, he said, you can be whatever you want to be. We travel everywhere and whatever you want to be. And what we'll do is you guys seem to want to hang and smoke weed together. We'll make sure that you guys are stationed at the same place. What you want to be? And I told him, well, I got this skill. This is what I do. Oh, we can use you. Right. We promise you we're going to get you into your field. So he said, well, what we're going to do, get you time to get that dope out your system. You know, what you want to do is a couple of weeks from now, we're going to call you. We're going to come pick you up. So me and my buddy made a pact with each other. We wasn't going to get high anymore. We jogging back and forth, going up to Haynes Point, running, not smoking weed. And they called us to go in. And when they called us to go in, we had to go do this physical, and they weighed us in. Well, when they weighed us in, I think you had to weigh something like 135 pounds to get in. Well, my buddy was like 160. I was 133, right? So he went in his truck. I guess they used to doing this. He grabbed me like a whole box of bananas and stuff. Said, hey, look, just be eating on these. And they weighed me in again, and I didn't weigh in. And a week from that, they shipped my buddy off to Paris Island. And he told me, he said, look, about a week or two from now. And he said, well, next time is going to be about a month from now. You know, we'll come. We'll call you back. By that time, eat a lot of pasta, eat a lot of bread, you know, bulk up. So I decided, okay. But when my buddy left and the guy told me a month from now, I was like, well, I can probably get higher. A little bit, and 3 weeks from now, I'll tighten up again, you know, I'll be all right. And I started getting high again, and 2 weeks later, they called me, you know. And I was ashamed to tell them, look, man, I'm getting high again, you know. And I was getting tired of being in the neighborhood. So I said, heck, you know, I'm going to go ahead and do this. Well, I weighed enough this time. Sent me off to Paris Island, South Carolina. I think at that time I was probably 20, 19. I think I was fresh, a year out of high school. So you get out at 17, 18. I was probably 19 years old. I'm on Paris Island. This was years ago. I don't remember how long the boot camp was, but I was like a week from graduating boot camp. Big staff sergeant called me in the office and said, you know, man, we got a little problem. We need to talk. And I'm like, okay. Well, how much weed were you smoking? Just a little bit. You know, we used to get the three-finger lids. Three-finger and the four-finger lids. That's how you knew how much you were getting. You put your four fingers up against the bag. Look, it's only 3.5. You got to give me some more. Make it. Give me what I paid for. Man, I think I was smoking about a lid a week. He was like, man, how much weed are you smoking? You know, I said, just a little bit. You know, he said, nah, you're not smoking just a little bit. You know, you got a lot of drugs in your system. And, you know, Marines don't like people that smoke dope. He said, but what we can do is you got an option. You can start all over. I think it's 14 weeks. I was in the 13th week. He said, you know, you can go back to week one. Or what we can do is we can give you what's called an entry-level separation. We'll allow you to go home. And I thought about it. Like, these big men hollering at me all the fucking time. And boot camp was real fucked up. Excuse my language. Look, just give me my pass. Let me go home. But at first, it's not dishonorable, right? Because everybody told me you never want that. He said, no, it just means that you're not fit for us. We're not fit for you. You go back to your weed. That ain't what he said, but that's what he was saying. And that's what I was reading him saying. And so, you know, I got my pass to come back home. They put me on a bus. Then they flew me down, man. You know, first class. And they gave me a Greyhound bus ticket back home. So when I got back home, I was ashamed to call my family and let them know that I had failed one more time. So I called my friends, you know, and they were like, man, it's cool. We come get you. They came and got me, and I got high for a couple of days. And I, you know, I went from the beer to the marijuana to the snorting cocaine. I mean, to smoking hash and all that stuff. But the thing is, my life just kept getting, the cycle is what I'm trying to show you. I'd do something positive, I'd fail, and I'd go back to the drugs. But this happened over and over again, and that was my pattern. And then, as I got older, you know, I came in this fellowship at 27 years old, do the math or something like that. 27, I came in here. Well, at 26, going back and forth, I got married. I would always get clean on my own. I didn't know anything about, never heard of Narcotics Anonymous. I just got tired of being the way I was doing, and somehow I was able to get clean and get another haircut, get another job, get another apartment, get another girlfriend. And I started making money in the trade that I had went to school for. And I met a young lady, and we got married, and I was still smoking weed and hashish and that kind of stuff, but I hadn't been introduced to crack cocaine. And, you know, we got married. Well, she got pregnant first, to tell you the truth. She got pregnant, and I decided I wanted to do the right thing, so I asked her to marry me. And we got married when she was about maybe 4 months pregnant, and got the apartment, and I was still hanging out with drug addicts. And I got introduced to crack cocaine with a baby on the way and a new marriage. And she was getting bigger. I was getting higher. And by the time the baby was born, I was a full-blown crack addict. I was making really good money. I was bringing home, you know, anywhere between $800 and $1,100 a week. And I was smoking it all. We lived in an apartment on Rhode Island Avenue, and the rent was $250. I couldn't come up with half. I just kept getting high. You know, the baby was born. I showed up to see my son get born. After he was born, I went and got high. I told her I was going to go to the apartment to clean the apartment up and paint it and all that stuff. I went and cleaned the bank account out. And it was time to bring the baby home. When we brought the baby home, you know, nothing was cleaned up. There was no food in the refrigerator. And I was a fool. You know, I was caught up in my disease. And it was time for the Pampers, you know, time for Pampers and the Similac and all that stuff. And I was getting paid on Friday, and I was showing up home Saturday morning. I remember my wife telling me, you know, we need Pampers and we need Similac. And I'm like, all the money was gone, but I couldn't tell her that. So I said, look, okay, I'll be back. And I went to my mom's house, and I told her, I said, look, we need Pampers and we need Similac. And she gave me $40. What did I do with the I ain't buying no Pampers. I ain't buying any Similac. I got high again. And, you know, I taught this woman how to not believe in me, because I was dishonest, I was distrustful, I was a liar. all the things that we are as addicts. You know, when we say addicts, we understand. You guys know exactly who I am. And, you know, I end up going into treatment centers at that point. You know, I went to a treatment center. I came out. I stayed clean for a little while, carrying the basic texts, going to meetings. I was getting high going to meetings, carrying the basic texts. My wife was seeing me carrying this basic text, but I wasn't staying clean, and she was really getting frustrated with me. She didn't believe in Narcotics Anonymous because I wasn't giving her a reason to believe in Narcotics Anonymous. And she ended up packing up and leaving me. She went back to New York, lived with her mom, took my son. And when I came to the apartment, she was gone. For a while, I was really distraught. I was like, oh, my life is through. But then I thought about it. Man, I got an apartment now. I ain't got to be hiding getting high. And it was off. You know, it didn't last long because then I had free will. You know, when you're trying, hiding, and sneaking to get high, you can stretch it out a little longer. You know, when you got free will, for me, when I had free will, you know, the disease just took me over. And I have six sisters. One of them tried to help me. You know, I would live with one. Well, I had my own apartment and all that stuff. And the first one, they all saw that I was in trouble. And they all tried to help me one at a time. Well, I went through all of them. But every one of them, I told them what I needed when they asked me. They said, you need help. I said, you're right, I need help. I need you to get my car insurance caught up. You know, the rent is 3 months back. Got no groceries. If you could just help me do that, I'll be all right. Well, the first one would do that. Got to the second one. This time I ain't got no car. You know, I'm on riding the Metro bus. So I tell her, look, the rent is low. I ain't got no money in my pocket. You know, we need some groceries. That one would do it. The next one, the wife gone, you know, the apartment gone and all of that. Can you just give me a couple of dollars and give me somewhere to live? You know. Then the next one, when I lived with her, I was causing a rift in her family. Because she was trying to help me, and I wasn't trying to help myself. And my brother-in-law was getting frustrated. And he was like, why are we enabling this fool? And she was like, look, this is my brother. So I was causing problems in that family, so she shipped me to the next sister because she didn't want her situation to get too funky. Well, each one told the other one, leave him alone because he ain't trying to do right. He's just going to tear your family up. But each one thought that she was going to be the one to help me. And that last one, when I went through her, yeah, it was all over. You know, at that time, my wife, I somehow talked her into coming back. I was clean for a couple of weeks. Things were going good. I was bringing a paycheck home. Then one day I got paid. I was on that Metro bus, and I saw the dope man. I couldn't pass him by. It was a Friday. I got high, spent all the money again, and here I am. You know, you feel, how did I get here again? I was there again. And, well, this time I was in the crack house. I had spent all my money, about $1,100, $20 at a time. Wasn't no drugs left, wasn't nobody giving me none. And everybody that I was serving was like, man, you can't have none. So I'm in this crack house, and the guy told me, you know, the money's gone, you got to leave, man. I'm afraid to go, and I'm afraid to stay. And I'm like, man, I ain't going nowhere. I'm staying right here. Paranoia kick in. Hear stuff at the window, people at the door. They were telling me, ain't nobody at the door. They look out the window, wasn't nobody there. Shut up, crackhead, ain't nobody there. When I was using, people could call me anything. You know. So there was nobody at the door, and they told me, look, we tired of this fool. So they went to the back section of the house. You just sit up here and look stupid. So I heard somebody at the door again. And I went back, look, man, somebody's at the door. And they like, man, close the door, the room that they were in. Well, I went back up. I'm trembling. I'm scared because I'm thinking it's the DEA. It's my mother. It's my sisters. You know, everybody that you're afraid going to catch you. And the door, somebody kicked the door in. It was really somebody. Kicked the door in, and the guy cocked the shotgun, and he was looking for Greg. I said, I ain't Greg. So when he saw I wasn't Greg, him and his two boys went to the back of the house. I went out the front of the house, right? And I learned today that those were my angels. Those are my angels, because I came out of that crack house and I called my sister. I went back to the first one again, because the rest of them were through with me. So I called that first sister again. I said, "Sister, I need some help." And I told her I needed some help. And she said, "Well, what kind of help do you need?" And this time I told her, "I don't know. I didn't have an idea. I was fresh out of ideas. I don't know. I just need some help." You know, by this time I had been through the sponsorship thing and the meetings and the rehabs, and they all pulled intervention. They pulled an intervention on me with my sponsor, my six sisters, my mother. Well, when my sister came and got me, first she said, "Where are you?" I said, "I'm on Rhode Island Avenue." She said, "Just sit there. I'll be there." It took her about 2 hours to get there, and when she came in a minivan with my nephew. And when I got in the van, my nephew, because they always hid from my family what I was doing. They were just like, "John is doing this or he doing that," because I couldn't show up for family events anymore because I was ashamed. And they were just like, "Well, John is doing such and such," and my nephews never knew what I was doing. When I got in the van, my nephew was like, "Hey, Uncle John, how you doing?" And my sister looked at him and said, "That's not your nephew. I mean, that's not your uncle. That's not my brother. You know, I don't know. This is just a drug addict that needs some help." And, you know, they pulled the intervention on me, and they got my sponsor there, and they said, "Well, you know, what should we do?" And I looked at my sponsor for some help, right? He was like, "Man, whatever they tell you to do, you know?" And they put me in one more treatment center. When I got in that treatment center, I got, you know, H&I came in, and H&I always came in, but when they came in, they were the first one, "Hi, John, how you doing? Introduce you to Narcotics Anonymous, the Sex Treatment Center." H&I come in, "Hi, John, how you doing? We seen you in meetings before. When you get out, come back to meetings. It's all right, man. Just come back to meetings." The third one, "Hey, John, you in treatment again? Look, when you come out, come to meetings. It's going to be all right." Well, this last treatment center, when I went in, H&I came in, somebody told me the truth. And they told me it wasn't all right to get high. Instead of them telling me, "Look, man, it's okay, just come to meetings," this one told me, "Look, man, what you're doing ain't right. You can't keep getting high." And I don't know. I was like, "Man, but y'all supposed to tell me it's all right? Just keep coming back?" He said, "Aren't you tired of being lied to? You know, aren't you tired of keep going through the same thing that you're going through? The adversities and then the strength." He was my first source of strength when they finally told me the truth. "Look, that ain't right. It ain't all right to get high." And when I left there, I went to the treatment center. When I left the treatment center, I wanted to go back home and live on 9th and Buchanan with my mother. And they told me not to do it, to go to Oxford House. You know, I went to Oxford House with 10 guys. You know, I had to pay my rent. I had chores. You know, we shared about stuff at night. I had guys who had went through marriages and stuff and that failed. And there were guys that went through marriages that were successful by staying clean. I was in service. I was doing service commitments, going to meetings. I got a home group. I started doing the things that you guys told me to do instead of picking and choose what I want to do. Well, yeah, I'll get with the sponsor, but I ain't going to do the steps. Or, yeah, I'll get with the sponsor, and I'll get me a home group, and I'll get me a service commitment, but I ain't going to do the steps. I was always picking and choosing what I wanted to do, and what I found out was when I started doing everything that you guys told me to do, I started seeing my life get better. And even today, I'm afraid not to do certain things, because out of the 9 or 10 things that I do, I don't know which one is sustaining me. You know, I've been on H&I since I had 6 months. I've never let it go. I had one H&I commitment for 6 years. I have 2 H&I commitments now. I have a home group. I have a sponsor. I have sponsees. I'm involved in Narcotics Anonymous. You know, everybody that I hang around is in Narcotics Anonymous, except for the people that on my job. I stay away from them. And one of my most difficult things, I don't know if you guys, you know, I'm a training instructor. And I have to get up in front of people like this. You know, I don't give a shit about them, excuse me. I'm just doing my job trying to get a paycheck. And, I have to really pray, because I'm afraid to get up in them and say, "Hey, my name is John, I'm an addict." And it's not that I'm ashamed to be an addict. I just don't, they don't need to know my business. You know? Because I guarantee you things in my job will change drastically if I do that. And they'll call it something else. They'll call it a name of, "Hey, all of a sudden, you're not doing your job." because people are still of the belief that once an addict, always an addict. And they true, but they don't know it. Once an addict, always an addict, but the lie is dead. You know, a lot of us aren't using anymore. A lot of us are living the way we're supposed to live. And what I found for me, Narcotics Anonymous, you know, it's damage control. Narcotics Anonymous is damage control for me. Because I still say things I shouldn't say. I do things I shouldn't do. And sometimes I go places that I shouldn't be. But what I found out is I can stop at any time. 2 years I had to end up getting divorced. Because she didn't believe in NA, even though I had a little bit of clean time. Because she was saying, look, you clean now, but still you ain't coming home. Because I was in a network of guys that you get to the meeting early and you stay late. And this guy that was taking me to meetings, he was picking up 8, 9 people, man. We was asshole Titan cars. And I would always be the last one that he'd drop off because he saw that I needed that kind of help. And once he dropped me off, he wouldn't let me out the car for about an hour. We still had to talk. So I'd be gone for 4 or 5 hours. I was still getting home 11, 12 o'clock at night. So I kind of see what she was looking at. But that's what I needed. That's what I needed. Had I not done that, you know, I wouldn't be here today. I'm in my second marriage. How long have we been married? I think 5 years. Going on 7 years. Oh my God. That's amazing. And that's true because my third anniversary, I should have remembered that, right? I've been married 7 years, man. And my wife knows. She know that women going to call the house, men going to call the house. They no telling what time they going to call. And it's about Narcotics Anonymous. I've never slept with anyone in Narcotics Anonymous. You know, I've been faithful to my wife. Because my first marriage went up in a ball of flames, yo. And I remember the feeling. Child support kind of hurt, too. But I know today that I'm responsible for that guy, you know, my son. And being a parent is not an option. You know, a lot of people choose to be optional parents, but, you know, it's not an option. But my wife knows that recovery comes first. You know, she does service. She does everything. She's pretty much worked everything. And it's important to have people that support you like that. You know, and you know, my life is unbelievable. And I never thought that just coming in here and living through the adversities. And I go through adversity every year coming across Bay Bridge. I'm afraid of heights. But I pray and I come across it. But what I know is as an addict, you know, I have to just keep an attitude of surrender and humility. If I'm not practicing those two things, I'm about to jackpot myself. And I think I shared enough. You know, that's my story, and I'm sticking to it. And if you ever hear me in a meeting sharing anything other than this, ask me why I'm lying. And that's why I keep people around me that know me so that I can stay straight. I got a brother JR right here. And this guy come in, and he's in service like me. And when you see somebody that's willing and stay willing, you know, we got it. We got a chance of staying clean and our lives getting better. They talk about new dreams awakening. I'm living a dream. I am living a dream because I always just wanted to be responsible. And I wanted to be responsible. I wanted someone to love me, and I wanted to find somebody that I could love. And I found a whole group of people that love me and a lot of people that I could love, and I always didn't understand. You know, when I went to that last treatment center, I didn't want to go there. And when it was time to leave, I was afraid to leave. And I was telling the guy, I can't go out there. Can you keep me a couple of more days? And he was like, well, you know, we'll keep you a couple of more days. And that last time before I was going to leave, H&I came in again. And you know what they told me? You don't have to be afraid of the world. You know, only thing you got to worry about is people, places, and things. Those are going to be the things that get you in trouble. So I surrounded myself with people that were staying clean. I surrounded myself with the people that I wanted to be like. And today I'm a success story, you know. You know, I got a lot of hope. I give a lot of hope. And I know that it's only contingent on what I do today, because I could leave this marathon, this meeting, and I could, on my way home, get some dope. You know, so, you know, this 11 years I got, I'm proud of it, and I love it, and I'm glad that I have it, but it doesn't mean that I'm going to be clean tomorrow. I still have to keep doing the things that I do. And that's what I keep doing. And I'm glad that I had the opportunity to do this. I'm glad that you guys were patient with me. And thanks for letting me share.
Thank John for sharing. At this time, I'd like to introduce our second speaker, Joyce B.
Good morning. Good morning. I'm Joyce B. I'm from Washington, D.C., and I am an addict. And it's through the grace of this God-given fellowship, and I thank God for being here. You know, I mean, this is awesome. This fellowship is so awesome. Last night, I was just, in awe of the performance that they threw. You know, we are some talented people. John, he already did the definitions for adversity for me anyway. But I just want to read a little something right here from the big book. And it's from More Will Be Revealed. And we are talking about strength through adversity. Often we have to face some type of crisis during our recovery, such as death of a loved one, financial difficulties, or divorce. These are realities of life, and they don't go away just because we get clean. Some of us, even after years of recovery, found ourselves jobless, homeless, and penniless. We entertained the thought that staying clean was not paying off, and the old thinking stirred up self-pity, resentment, and anger. No matter how painful life tragedies can be for us, one thing is clear: we must not use no matter what. And that's what I have to look at today. No matter what, I can't use. My sponsor, Debbie P., was supposed to do this workshop. And I was at work, and she called me on the phone and said, I'm not going to be able to make it because my mother's in the hospital, and she's sick. And her father wasn't doing too well, and she said, I want you to go do the workshop for me. She said, you can do it, and it's on strength through adversity. So I hesitated for a minute. She said, hello, are you there, or did you faint? Okay? And I said, oh, Debbie, you're not coming. So she said, no, you can handle it. And the thing was about that is because I always dreamt about speaking at the convention. You hear what I'm saying? I always wanted to do this. You know, and I'm going to tell you, after she told me that, I enjoy this convention. I'm telling you, I enjoy every convention that I go to. But I was still boggled about getting up here. What can I talk about with adversities? And here's what I'm going to start off with. My sponsor, the one I'm talking about that's supposed to be here, January the 10th, her husband got, you know, shot on 14th Street. You know, they were doing vendings. And he didn't die right on the scene, but he got shot 8 feet away from where she was standing. Whew. You know, we have a close-knit, you know, relationship. I have a close-knit relationship with my sponsor, with people in my network, and with a lot of other people outside of Narcotics Anonymous. And, you know, she's just going through. And the way she get into a meeting, or even when the funeral was there and she had to get up there and speak, I mean, I look at her, I've never seen nobody go through like she's going through. You hear what I'm saying? I've never seen so much strength in a person. You hear what I'm saying? But this fellowship is awesome. You know, this fellowship, thank you. This fellowship is really awesome because I watched how they came in there. I mean, people from, she's the chair of DC Area Service. Everybody from DC Area Service was there, everybody in their home group, and I mean a lot of people from Narcotics Anonymous was there, you know, to support her. And I just watched it, you know, that's what I like. They're talking about that observance, and I look at a lot of you all, I heard people talk about, I come in these meetings and listen to the story. I hear people talk about, it was a gentleman that talked about his family. His whole family got burned up in the house. And he didn't pick up. You hear what I'm saying? I came in here, and I was one of those when I first came around in 91 that thought I had a lot of secrets. My first sponsor didn't have nothing but 1 year, but she told me dope fiends don't have secrets. You hear what I'm saying? And I still thought I had a lot of things that I just wasn't ready to tell anybody, you know what I'm saying, that y'all wouldn't understand. And I believe, you know, that God saved me when I needed to really be saved. You know, he gave me the second chance when I was ready. What happened was, I'm one of those that's not able to, or wasn't able to, grieve deaths. Okay, I've been working on that. And what happened, what brought that to my attention is that, okay, I would never go to funerals, you know, especially since I got here. I said, well, I don't go to funerals. I want to remember people just like they were. You hear what I'm saying? But the real deal was, you know, every time I go and think about death, I think about my mother, my father, you know, because, see, I wasn't even around when they died. You know what I'm saying? I think about my sister, and, you know, and I think about Tony, you know. But Tony's was the first funeral that I went to. And it wasn't as frightening as I thought it was. You know, my sponsor helped me with that. You know, when I got in there and I seen this fellowship working, you know, I mean, it just sent chills through my body. I couldn't believe it. But nevertheless, I wanted to share something with you all, and then I'm going to give you a little bit of my story. Last Sunday, I was coming down the elevator of my building. When the elevator door opened up, my nephew was standing right there in front of me. And he's suffering from a mental illness. He has schizophrenic, and I don't know what else is going on with him, you know, but he's on a lot of heavy medication. And I know him. After he get, when he stopped taking his medication, he's drinking and he's using. You hear what I'm saying? So when he was there, he kept saying, oh, Joyce, can I ask you something in the name of Jesus? I said, what you want to ask me, Benson? My first thought, you know, oh, he's going to ask me for some money for some cigarettes. Because basically that's what all he asks me for. So he said, oh, can I ask you something? I said, go ahead, Vincent. Tell me what you want to talk about. He said, oh, okay. Are you going to tell me the truth? I said, what is it? Then what he said to me is, did you have anything to do with Vivian's death? And Vivian is my older sister. She died. She jumped off the train December the 15th of 1995. And she had a mental illness also. That wasn't this is the time that she did try to take her life and succeeded, because several times she tried to cut her wrists and a whole lot of other things, you know. And I never was able to grieve that death. You know what I'm saying? So I asked him, I said, why are you saying something like this to me? He said, I said, who told you that? He said, nobody told me that. It was revealed by God. So I said, no, Vincent, I did not kill my sister. He said, oh, so Jesus is a lie. God is a lie. I said, your God is lying to you. I don't know where you get that from. And I really wanted to go there with him. I wanted to hurt him like he hurt me, because I was hurt behind that. You know what I'm saying? And I was very angry. I just walked off, and he kept hollering across the street. And matter of fact, I was on my way to a meeting when this happened. See how God works. You know, he also reveals things to you that help you go through. You know what I'm saying? I could have went out and used on that, but I didn't. I chose not to. I went to a meeting. I went to pick up one of my sponsees. I shared it with her. I shared it when I got into a meeting, and a good thing, it was one of my predecessors sitting up there talking. Oh, it was at a women's rap. I told her how I was feeling, and she told me, you know, God put things in front of us, and you already knew he was sick. That's why you really didn't go off. You know, I wanted to say some real hurting things to him. Because, see, that's how I used to handle a lot of things in my family. I use my mouth as a weapon, you know. And I was listening to this young man right here talking about some things of his past, and all I remember is every time someone died, and my father died when I was like 18 years old. It was 2 months after I graduated from high school, and he died at home. I came home from my little summer job. They wouldn't let me upstairs. They were waiting for the coroner. And me and my father was very close. I couldn't handle it. I couldn't handle it. You know, I knew I was too young to go in the liquor store myself. You know, so I got one of the winos to go in the liquor store for me and wasn't hid in one of my friend's house and drink. Heard my mother calling me and everything. You know, and I wasn't able to deal with that. But after coming here to Narcotics Anonymous, this is where I get my strength from. You hear what I'm saying? I get my strength coming here. You all told me to sit up front, shut my mouth, let you love me until I can learn to love myself. You hear what I'm saying? And get myself a God. Okay, I came in here, I got my sponsor. And I had no problem talking about what was going on with me. And don't think that it just started off like that. Because, see, relapse is a part of my story. I've been to 4 treatment facilities, a slew of detox centers. You hear what I'm saying? And I never went to the same place twice because I was full of shame and guilt, full of it. You know, I look at some of my other adversities. What happened? I was fondled by my brother. I was raped twice in the military. And when that thing happened with my brother, I was 9 years old. And the only thing I could think of when this was happening is, when I get old enough to get a job, I'm not going to never ask nobody for nothing. I don't want nobody to do nothing for me. I want my brothers and them to stay the F away from me. This is stuff that was going through my mind at 9 years old. So from 14 up until the time I came in Narcotics Anonymous, I had some type of job if it wasn't number 10. And see, I'm going to tell you, when I had jobs, when I was out there, when my disease took off, what I did was I would quit the job because it got in the way of my using. Okay? I go to work, get a nice paycheck, and I'll leave the job because, hey, I got enough money. Go up there to New York, get me a package. I'll come down here and sell some of it. I won't use as much. I'll stop shooting dope and just snort it, you know. I won't drink as much, you know what I'm saying? And I did it all, you know. I did everything in my power to get here, you know. I get a lot of my strength from people right here in Narcotics Anonymous. You know, I come in here, like I said, if it wasn't for me coming into Narcotics Anonymous and listening to your story, just sit down long enough to give myself a chance. You know what I'm saying? Stop identifying out. I remember coming, sitting in the front seat, and soon as anybody, a man or woman, start talking about rape, I'll get up and leave this, and excuse myself and go to the bathroom and get in there and cry. People had to come and knock on the door to see if I was all right. You know, I'm getting a little better with that because I'm starting to talk about it so I can, you know, I want this all for me. You hear what I'm saying? I mean, this is one thing that really baffled my spirit when I came in here, talking about molestation and rape, you know. And I am a victim of rape, you know, so I have to come in here and talk about it. You know, that's the only way I'm going to get some help. And I'm getting a lot of help from, you know, I get a lot of help from you all. I also suffer from another disease, which is depression, you know. And if it wasn't for me coming in here, sharing about how I was feeling and about depression, and just hearing other people share about once they got clean and they went to the doctor, what happened was after they started taking the medication and getting their sessions in, the voices stopped and they had to go out and smoke no more crack. They said, because let me tell you something, don't deprive yourself from getting some other help outside of the fellowship. Some of us need that. So I do go to groups outside of Narcotics Anonymous, and I'm on medication. And I take my medicine because at first I was on and off of it. I didn't like the way it made me feel, but they said your body had to get used to it. And I did myself a lot of harm while I was out there because I didn't know I had a second illness. You know, this adversity thing, you know, the strength through adversity. Like I said, I get all my strength from people right here in Narcotics Anonymous, from my sponsor, and from the God of my understanding. I have a God today. You know, I came in here and I used you alls until I got on my feet. And you all told me to get a suit that would fit me. And that's what I did today. And I was real nervous when I got in here too, you know. And I came in here and prayed. And my sponsor called me before I got here. And she told me that I'll do well. You know, this is awesome. I just want to let you know this fellowship is awesome. And I still tell people today, if no one else has told you that they love you today, I love each and every one of y'all. You know, and one more thing I just wanted to say real quick. I wanted to tell you one thing before we all leave, the story about the butterfly. And I know each one of y'all know about the story of the butterfly. Okay, you know, I remember when I came in here, and as I started to grow, I wasn't seeing myself growing, but other people were watching me. You know, people watch you in the fellowship. And what happened was, they used to always say, Joyce, you're turning into a butterfly. You know, I never knew about the struggles of the butterfly, you know. So someone explained it to me is that the butterfly is in this cocoon, right? You know, it's the cocoon. And when the butterfly comes out, he's going through a struggle. He's trying to, his little body is trying to get his wings to properly, flap so he can get his way up out of this cocoon, you know. So one day a man was looking at, the butterfly was struggling so much. What he did was help the butterfly out of the cocoon. But now his body is big, his little wings are shriveled, and he walks in for the rest of his life, he just crawled around, never able to fly. And what happened was the man enabled this butterfly. That's what happened. He wouldn't allow the butterfly to go through the struggles so all of the juices in his body could go through his wings, and that his wings would be bigger than his body, but his body ended up being bigger than his wings. And what it is that sometimes we can enable people. I'm a big enabler, you know. I'm working on it, you know, and I see myself even with the struggle, you know, that the butterfly went through. You know, I was doing the same thing. You know, but through my struggles, I always share with somebody. I have to share with somebody. I share with my sponsor, my sponsees. When I'm in a meeting, I don't always do a lot of talking, but if someone's on a subject and I see that I can get some help and I can also give some help, I also go ahead and share that as well. So I have got a lot of my strength through adversities from Narcotics Anonymous and the God of my understanding. And I want to thank you for letting me share.
All right, y'all, we have 5 minutes left, and it says, thanks to those who shared. Let's thank everyone who shared. And let's close this meeting with a moment of silence followed by a serenity prayer.
Jar, give me
yeah, they're going to want that for y'all.